When you save on auto insurance for driving safe with USAA SafePilot, you'll feel like a big deal. Even in a traffic jam. Save up to 30% with USAA SafePilot. Restrictions apply.
Hi guys, Pete and Rich here. We've got another Boys in the Band podcast episode coming up in a moment. But first, a quick shout out to our sponsors at Beer 52.
Yeah, we may have fond memories of drinking pretty much anything on offer back at gigs back in the day, but we're a bit more selective these days, and Beer 52 have a great collection. They come up with a great deal just for our listeners to the Boys in the Band podcast.
Yeah, so if you fancy a free case of 8 craft beers from Beer 52, go to beer52.com/band, and all you have to do is cover the postage costs of $5.95. That sounds like a good deal to me, Rich.
Does indeed. And not just that, as well as a free case, you'll also get signed up to Beer 52's Beer Club, the largest in the world with over 150,000 active members. Each month, members are sent a case with a different theme, as well as a magazine and a snack too. So you can, of course, pause or cancel the offer at any time, but it's well worth trying out.
Yep, leave those bad beers you used to get gigs behind and get on this stuff, and head over to beer52.com/band for that offer.
Yep, get on that, kick back, crack open a beer, and enjoy the next pod. Hello and welcome to the Boys in a Band podcast. I'm Richard Gallagher.
And I'm Peter Smith. And on this week's show, we're joined by a very special guest. It's Gary Powell from the Libertines. We're delighted to land Gary for this podcast. It's one of the stories we've been wanting to tell from the very start. And Gary didn't disappoint.
He sure didn't. And as you can imagine, there were some wild stories about life in the band. But Gary also pointed out that success didn't just come to the band. They had to work for it.
The drive and tenacity to actually take it somewhere was kind of like unparalleled. It was literally just full on. We're gonna go for this. We're totally gonna go for this. Pete and Carl had, at that point in time, they had nowhere to live. They were dossing on people's couches left, right, and center. Their whole life became getting this sorted out. And they were sorting out the music, and the music they were bringing to the table was just like, I was just like, wow, this is so fun to play.
Yeah, Gary mentions those early tours there, and we discussed some incredible live shows and what it's like to be on stage during those gigs when it's all going off.
Plus, we dissect all three albums with Gary, who gives us the inside story and how they were written and recorded.
Well, she can't talk about the Libertines without talking about that fascinating relationship between Pete and Carl. And Gary reflects on his own experiences of them, their bond, their talent, and the challenges they both had to overcome together and on their own.
Yeah, and as well as that, Gary also gives us an update on new music from the band they've been working on recently, including a beauty from John. And their plans for 2021 sound really exciting. So sit back, enjoy the pod. Do remember to check us out on social media and leave us a review. But for now, here's Gary from the Libertines. This week on the Boys in the Band podcast, we're delighted to be joined by the legendary Gary Powell from the Libertines. Gary, how's it going?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Yeah, thanks for carrying on, Gary. It's great to have you on. We're excited to have you on. We're excited to talk about the Libertines, obviously a band that we both love, and I'm sure you've got some good stories for us as well.
Just about. I mean, I hardly ever see those guys anymore. I mean, apparently we're a band. Apparently, so. I don't know. Apparently we were working on new material as well. I don't know about that. Yeah, we are working on new material, and we are progressively moving forwards. Just sometimes it doesn't feel like that at all. Sometimes it just feels like, yeah, kind of like taking two steps forward and then dropping off the edge of a cliff behind you, which was 50 steps behind you as well. It wasn't even like right behind you, it's 50 steps behind you, but you still managed to fall off the back of the cliff anyway. That's kind of like what it's like being in the Libertines.
I can imagine it being like that. Yeah, that sounds like, just as good. I imagine.
Yeah. I'm glad we haven't kind of like ruined your thought process as to what we're actually like.
Exactly. That is what we're like. Well, before we get into the Libertine story, Gary, we start with the sound check. Three quick questions to get us warmed up, get us fired up. And the first one is, whereabouts are you?
I am in my studio at home in Stoke Newington. I've just been helping my son do some homework, and now I'm just sat in the place that I call home solace, my studio, where I can just kind of like just stay out of everybody's way.
All right, next up, Gary, what are you into at the moment? What bands are you listening to?
Bands I'm listening to at the moment. I'm loving the Lemon Twigs at the moment. I think the Lemon Twigs are kind of killing it. I'm loving them. It's a mixed bag of stuff. I'm loving, the Robert Glasper experiment. I'm loving all of that stuff. It's kind of like neo soul, neo jazz. The new album from the Blue Note Revisited, I think it's absolutely amazing. With Jordan Hackey's version of Poppy Ajuda's version of Watermelon Man by originally done by Herbie Hancock is just absolutely. It's an amazing version of a track that is as. Amazing originality you've done back in the early 70s anyway, but her variation in that is just absolutely amazing. I'm into, what else am I into? Oh, I'm loving the Fontaines D.C. Fontaines D.C. are pretty much my favorite band at the moment. Who else am I loving? When it comes to music, I try not to be too much of a one-trick pony. I like everything, you know, because there's, especially from a musician standpoint, there's something to be taken from every single genre of music that you can actually then add to your own genre of performance or your own genre of, say for instance, if within the Libertines, if I just listened to, I don't know, the New York Dolls, for instance, then if that was my only form of approach, then you would get the drumming of somebody who just listens to the New York Dolls. And if that is the case, then why would you listen to us? Why not just listen to the New York Dolls? If it's going to end up sounding like the New York Dolls, you may as well listen to the original. Whereas if you can actually listen to as many different things as possible and just steal a little bit from here and steal a little bit from there and just add that to the part, that's when you actually get something really, really interesting. And that's what the listener wants. The listener wants something interesting. The listener, unbeknownst to them, generally speaking, when listening to most of the bands, especially within the indie genre is specifically really good at massive plagiarism. Indie lovers love indie music. Indie musicians love everything. And they listen to everything and they steal a little bit from there. The listener is just like, oh, I just love indie. I love indie. I love the Strokes. I love the Maccabees. But the Maccabees, they're listening to everything and they're just stealing a little bit from there, stealing a little bit from there, and creating something completely new. And that's kind of where, that's definitely where I'm from. I'm from the whole ideology of like, if it's good, I'm going to listen to it. And if it's really good, I'm going to try and replicate it in my own way and then bring it to the table and see if it's something that we can actually do to make something new ourselves.
Yeah, wide range of influences then. And the third question in the soundcheck was, obviously before we got locked down, what gigs were you going to? What can you remember a good recent gig?
That's a toughie. God, a good recent gig. Man, I've been at, but one of the questions that I've been asking everybody recently is, do you remember what life was like before lockdown? And most people are like, actually, no, I don't. I can't remember it. Life before COVID. And I still consider this second phase of lockdown to be the first phase of lockdown.
Yeah, we're not back to normal at all, are we?
We're not back to normal. We never did get back to normal. It's not as if we came out of lockdown and went, everybody, go back to normal. It's fine. The world could revert back to normal. All we did was kind of like creep our heads out of our little holes, and we went out for a meal every now and again. We sat in the sun for 5 minutes, and then went, all right, everybody, back in your holes. Back in your holes you go. As far as I'm concerned, is first lockdown 1.2. Yeah. This isn't lockdown 2. There was no track and trace. There was no nothing. There was nothing of that nature to give me any impression that we are going into the second phase. As far as I'm concerned, this is all still the first phase, because we never resolved anything from the first phase. So with regards to your question, what gigs did I go to before? I'm trying to remember any gigs I went to. I'm trying to think. What did I go and see? Did I go and see anything last year? I can't think. I'm gonna have to come back to you on that one, because I can't think of anything, and I don't want to lie and just say I went to a gig. There will be gigs I went to, I can't think of any right now, because I think about is my space that I'm in and just kind of just being alone in here.
Well, Gary, maybe we could take you back 20 years or so then instead and go back to the start of the Libertine story. And so let's start at the beginning. What are your first impressions then of joining the band? How that came about? First impressions of Pete and Carl?
There was a plethora of different characters. There was Scarborough Steve, who's a lead singer. There was John, there was a cellist. There was obviously Pete and Carl. And there was, oh God, what's his name? Mr. Rascox, he was on drums. That was the original foundations of what was the Liberties. But Mr. Rascox, he left for one reason or another. Scarborough Steve, he had to go. I think he went back to Scarborough because he was running out of money, blah, 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 the rest of it. John wanted to do his A-level, so he went back to school because he was still the youngest in the band. At that point in time, I was just finishing my tenor working with Eddie Grant. So I was already hot shit. I was already on TV doing stuff. I was already doing stuff. I was a celebrity. I was a star. I really wasn't. I was a session musician sitting in the background. Nobody knew who I was. I was just sitting in the background doing session musician work. And I got introduced to Pete and Carl by, I was working for East West Records out in Kensington. And the business affairs manager who lived by me, who just got the job, said, I got a couple of guys who really like you to meet. And I was like, all right, cool. So she took me to a pub, which was just around the corner from where I lived, because she lived in the neighborhood as well. And it was a pub that I went to anyway. And she went, hi, here's Pete and Carl. And I was like, I see these guys in here all of the time. And they were like, all right, mate. And then Carl asked me if I did, the first thing Carl said was, asked me was if I'd ever drank a David Niven's. At which point I was like, no. And then he offered me this drink that looked like Thames water. It was just absolutely disgusting, but it was a really, really, really nice drink. And then we just started chatting absolute nonsense. And obviously the characters between the two of them, I mean, that's kind of what sold it to me. And it originally had nothing to do with the music. It was just fun hanging out. I think they keep on saying that I turned up in like a big fur coat. Like, you know, like you see the horses. You see a man at the horse races and he got a big fur coat on and a big silly hat on and a big cigar and just kind of stood there and he's like paying shit loads of money. That's what they thought I looked like, and they took the piss out of me about that. And the relationship originally was purely platonic on the basis of their individual characters. And I just loved hanging out with them. When it actually came to them saying, oh, we actually do music as well, I was like, oh, that's interesting, cool. What do you do? And they play me some stuff. And then I was just like, that's really, really interesting. Because at that point in time, as I've kind of mentioned, I'm heavily into jazz. And they were heavily into the likes of Django Reinhardt and the like of that nature. And I was into that as well. So it was just like, oh, that's amazing. So we already had that kinetic energy with reference to music, and they were into the Beatles, and I was into the Beatles as well because my dad was into Billy Preston, the fifth Beatle, and Billy Preston was never the fifth Beatle, he was just a keyboard player, but he was actually very, very influential to the Beatles, as said by George Harrison. You didn't know that, now you do. so we got into all of that stuff, and then when it just came to like, you know, do you want to come down to the studio and play? That's what we did. We didn't go down with any other intentions than to keep on having a bit of a laugh and a few drinks. And because at that point in time, the band had fallen to pieces. And they were just like, well, let's just go. They still enjoyed playing. I was just finishing off working with Eddie Grant. So I was still enjoying playing. At that point in time, I think I was going to the Jazz Cafe on Sundays to do the jam sessions there. And then I was going down to Clapton to do a jam session down there as well. I was just trying to play with as many different people as possible, going around auditioning for different bands. I was actually in a band called the Minor Birds, which was like a really kind of like heavy-esque rock band run by this French dude who was like a real kind of like, he was like Macron. Yeah, very, very opinionated, very, 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 very kind of like forthright, and very kind of like a draconian Trump.
Okay. Yeah,
a really draconian Trump. The music was all right, though, and they were about to get a deal as well. But when it came down to, you know, later on, when I actually had to make a choice, it was like, well, do you want to play in a band with guys that you actually enjoy being with, or do you want like to be in the band where it's kind of more like a session gig? And it was just, we were like, well, no. But initially, it was literally, the relationship was just purely on the basis of we like drinking David Niven's.
Nice. And how long from that point on was it before you said you went down and started playing with them and having a bit of a jam with them, when you realised that, hey, these guys have got some good songs and some good ideas, and this is something that could go somewhere?
And, oh, and, we, yeah. once we started going, and Banny then said that she was going, you know, she said, oh, they've asked me to manage them. And she said, are you interested in being involved? And by that point in time, we'd done a few jams. We'd done a couple of jam sessions. Johnny Burrell was the bass player at that point in time. So it was kind of like, it was a fun setup for the time that we played with Johnny. I think he only turned up to a couple of rehearsals, and then he pissed off to Ireland or something like that. And then it was just me, Pete, and Carl. And it was just fun. It was a lot of fun. But I was kind of like between the three of them, between Pete, Carl, and Banny, because I've got a musical educational background, studied music, taught music in the States a lot, toured everywhere. I was working with Eddie Grant, blah, blah, all of the rest of it. I was in a sessions agency, just farming me out left, right, and center. They were just like, yeah, we're just going to put you in charge and let you just do your thing. And that's what they did. They just let me work them into the ground, basically. You know, I had a little crappy job in the city. I'd leave my crappy job, would help paying for studio times, paying for them for the majority myself. And we'd just get into the studio and we'd just work really, really hard on stuff. And I'd get pissed off when they'd make mistakes, and they would accept that because they'd never had anybody work with them like that before. And they never had anybody that was so kind of like draconian and really kind of like forthright, and this is how it has to be done, and we're going to do it like this. And they kind of got used to it, because after a while we between the three of us, we sounded really, really freaking good. And I have no trouble saying that we sounded great, because they were already great players, and they'd as you well know already, they'd written some great material. But because they were just kind of, I don't know, a little bit kind of laissez-faire about everything, they were just, everything just ended up being a little bit kind of jangly, and a little bit kind of like, it'll be all right, it's fine. And I was like, nah, it ain't going to be all right. Well, nah, it's not.
Well, that drive and structure from you obviously paid off, because we know about signing for Rough Trade in December 2001.
I think we got signed within, 3-4 months?
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, no, missing. It was full on constantly, and that's not just me. That was all three of us. Once we got told that this had legs, the three of us, the drive and tenacity to actually take it somewhere was kind of like unparalleled. It was like literally just full on. We're gonna go for this. We're totally gonna go for this. Pete and Carl had, at that point in time, they had nowhere to live. They were dossing on people's couches left, right, and center. Their whole life became getting this sorted out, and they were sorting out the music, and the music they were bringing to the table was just like, I was just like, wow, this is so fun to play. And it's, when I say that, I was really kind of like forthright with my opinions and so forth, I didn't really have to do a great deal with the music. On the other occasion, there'd be some suggestions as to that we need to do this with it, or this would be an idea, or we can maybe add this, blah, 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 all of the rest of it. But generally speaking, what they brought me, I was just like, I ain't messing with this. We're going to play this. And we're going to structure this in the way that you guys want it structured, and then we're going to lock it down, and you guys are going to be able to play this in your sleep, and it's going to be easy for you to play in your sleep. There's going to be no thinking about it. It's going to be so easily palatable by you that it's going to be really translatable to anybody else listening to it. That's what we worked on. We worked on that tirelessly, really, really hard. There was no pissing about. There's none of his rock and roll stories of just kind of like, we're just going to go get fucked every now and then. Bollocks to that. It was just hard work and graft. And that continued all the way through the first proper touring. That's what the mentality was. The mentality was just work. We're working. We ain't pissing around. We're working. And after we finished working, then we'd piss around.
So what are your memories of some of those early gigs then, Gary? You had some pretty big support slots early on with the Vines and the Strokes, is that right?
Well, even prior to those gigs, I mean, I remember the gig that that got assigned to Rough Trade Records. I mean, at that point in time, I mean, I was working, I had a little crappy job in the city, giving financial advice, reading from the script, walking into work every day, because I didn't really have enough money to get the tube or public transport. Saving money for studio time, saving money for rent. Pete and Carl were living and dusting in other people's flats and so forth, blah, blah, all of the rest of it. And then we got ourselves to a point where Rough Trade wanted to come see us play. So we got a gig at the Ribbon Factory in Whitechapel, the infamous Ribbon Factory. But only trouble is, it was only until we got the gig that we realized that we didn't actually have any equipment to play the gig. We had nothing. We were using studio equipment. We had nothing. So Pete and Carl, they rustled up a guitar, a bass guitar to play the show. But there was definitely one thing missing from the scenario, a drum kit. I didn't have a drum kit. I didn't have no money for a drum kit. Man, I was living in London, in North London, in a little flat. Where the hell did you put a drum kit? There was no room for a drum kit, let alone the money to buy a drum kit. Are you kidding me? There was no drum kit. So anyway, they managed to get one of their friends to lend us a drum kit. And it was all set up at the Ribbon Factory when we got there. When I saw it, I looked at it and was just like, what in the name of God and baby Jesus is that thing? It was green. It was huge, a huge, massive toms. It was literally like playing like an orchestral set of timpani. It was just like boom, 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 boom. Absolutely massive. The cymbals were, they'd made a frame around it, and the cymbals were hung with bits of rope. So if you hit the cymbal, it would just literally just swing everywhere. Just swinging cymbals everywhere. It was just mental. We managed to get through Horror Show, and I hit one cymbal, and then for the rest of it, I didn't hit any more cymbals because I spent the whole time dodging my head. I was going to get my head chopped off. And then Peter broke a string on the guitar, or Carl did, I think, because I think they were swapping bass duties. Yeah, they were definitely swapping bass duties at the time. And Peter broke a string in the guitar. We didn't have any spare strings. And so then we spent the next, 20 minutes or so of those guys trying to get another string so that we could actually carry on playing the gig. So I think we managed to play maybe two or three tracks, including nearly getting my head chopped off, including Pete and Carl wandering around outside everywhere trying to get the guitar string so they can carry on playing the gig. And then we managed to get through that. And then James Endicott saw it and went, oh my God, you were fucking brilliant. I want to sign you. And we were like, huh? What? That was the very, very beginning.
Libertines became quite infamous for those guerrilla gigs as well at Bethnal Green Flat as well, didn't they, Gary?
The Album Rooms was a lot of fun as well. That was a lot of fun. I used to always turn up to the Album Rooms quite late. I just kind of like turn up late and just like peek my head in and just kind of stand in the corner and just watch what was going on. I remember turning up once when the neighbor upstairs came downstairs with an axe. And I was trying to break the door down with an axe because it was so loud. And then the police arrived and everybody in the flat started just freaking out in the flat, including the boys. I was just like, what are you freaking out for? The police can't come in. They can't do anything. What's your problem? They, if you stay quiet, they can't do nothing. And even if they can do something, what can they prove? I don't see no paraphernalia or anything around. It's not a problem. And that happened a lot. And I used to spend my time laughing. And sometimes I'd even go downstairs. And this was Bethnal Green. The sole black guy there would be me. And the one person you think the police would want to arrest would be the sole black guy there. Because he's a drug dealer. Drug dealer, we're going to arrest a drug dealer. And I'd come downstairs laughing. And then they'd look at me and they'd be like, all right, mate. I'd be like, yeah, fine, we're upstairs. But nothing ever happened. Nothing ever happened. It was hilarious. It was very, very funny.
Brilliant, great fun those times. But let's get back to the music then, Gary, because you put out What a Waster and I Get Along as a double A-side in 2002. And then, Bernard Butler, and then started laying down up the bracket. So, obviously you ended up doing that with Mick Jones. So tell us about the story of that and your memories of laying down that debut.
The first thing I remember, we were rehearsing at a studio called, what was the studio called again? Jesus Christ. It was John Henry's. It was John Henry's on the Caledonia Road, as is mentioned in Up the Bracket, the Cali Road. Yeah. We were rehearsing there, imminently waiting for the arrival of Mick Jones. Prior to us actually meeting him. And he said he was going to arrive at about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the next thing we knew, it was like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd play for a little bit, sit around, have a few fags, bit of a drink, and play for a little bit more, Jonesy still hadn't turned up, and then he started pissing it down with rain. Eventually turned up in his suit, always looked dapper, always looked amazing. But he was absolutely drenched, soaking wet through, plastic bag in his hand. And he just went, oh, you know, I came to the studio, but I thought the studio was somewhere else. And when I went to one studio, it was the wrong studio. So then I got on another bus, and I went to another studio, and that was the wrong studio. I then ended up walking for ages. I got piss wet through. And we were just like, oh my God, you are literally cut from the same cloth. Yeah, he just literally cut from the same cloth, and then he came and he hung out. We played a little bit, but that meeting was mainly more about just kind of like getting to know each other. Mm-hmm. And we went, there was a pub around the back of the studio called the Albion. There's a lot of drugs there, surprisingly enough. And we went to the Albion and we sat down and we had a good old chat. And I remember one of the most thoughtful things that Jonesy actually said to us at that very particular point in time was that with reference to the Clash, he wished that they had mended their ways at any particular point. Well, especially prior to the death of Joe Strummer, specifically before the death of Joe Strummer, because obviously from that point in time, there's no turning back. And he just said the one thing that they all had in common was a love of music. And it's the one thing that they forgot. And I remember us all sitting down listening to that and kind of thinking, oh yeah, that's a damn shame, man. That's a, not thinking that a variation of that would ever happen to us. Not thinking that at all, but just looking at it from Mick's point of view, from the point of view of no matter how much we kind of like eulogize the Clash and the work that they've done, all of the struggles they must have gone through in order to actually get to a particular point in time for them only to then implode, acrimoniously implode as well, without actually ever being able to look at each other and go, hold on a second, what's the problem? There is a problem, but surely we can solve it, because the one thing that we all have in common is a love of music. And the only reason we're actually together is because we love music. So why can't we figure out our problems? They just weren't able to do that. So that was kind of like the very, very beginning of working with Mick. To be honest, because for us at that point in time, we'd never actually recorded as a band. We've done lots of demos in lots of different studios. Lots of them really, really cool. Some of them pretty, pretty crappy. But, you know, we've got demos out of it. And we'd listen back to the demos and we were like, yeah, but, you know, that's pretty cool. Never really overly excited about anything that we'd done. But, you know, but we'd been in studios at that point in time. When we started working again in RAC, but working with Mick Jones and working under his proviso, and his approach to recording with Bill Taylor, the engineer, he'd worked with the Beatles, he'd worked with everybody. He was just kind of like, him and Mick, they worked together constantly. And wherever there was a Mick Jones and Mick Jones was producing, there was a Bill Taylor and he was engineering. And without the engineering skills of Bill Taylor, Mick Jones's approach, he still would have gotten great stuff out of it. He still would have gotten the best out of us he could have done. But it was Bill that pushed us right over the edge and made it sound as it sounded for that point in time. And it was about it sounding kind of ethereal and edgy and dynamic and fresh and literally straight off the pages. Like, you know, it wasn't supposed to sound as if it had been ironed out and cleaned and the ridges smoothed out. It was supposed to be rough and ready, but really, really kind of like dynamic and emotionally charged as well. And that was a combination of Bill and Mick. And Mick's approach basically was just to get us playing to the point where he was really, really happy. And it was, you know, and I think to this day, with reference to recording with producers, and I've worked with Dave Sardi in LA, who's done the Chili Peppers. And, you know, I remember working with Sardi, and Sardi's thing was, you know, if we ever argued over something, specifically me, because I was always arguing with him, because I always had I've got my own approach with reference to arranging and the rest of it. Sardi's thing was with me, okay, Gary, we've got two warehouses. One warehouse is yours, the other warehouse is mine. In my warehouse, there's 500 million record sales. In your warehouse, there's okay, we'll do it my way. And it used to wind me up. That was his approach. That was his approach to doing it. Whereas Jones's approach was pretty much on the basis of, do it again. Now, do it again. Do it again. Oh, do it again. And then we knew we were onto something because we'd look into the studio and he'd be stood there with big spliff in his hands and he'd just be dancing along. And then we'd finish playing and he'd just press down the button and he'd just go, do it again. And that's what it was. That's exactly what it was. He just had us do it again and again and again and again. So we were that comfortable with it that it just literally just flew by. When we recorded Up the Bracket, I think within the course of 5 days, we recorded 22 tracks.
Wow.
It literally just flew by. And that's working tracks as well. Mm. That's not just like 3 tracks a day, 4 tracks a day or whatever. It's literally just really working, methodically working the tracks to a point where we heard something and it was just like, yeah. I mean, obviously, especially me, I can be a little bit of, what's the terminology I'm looking for? A profession, whatever. What am I trying to say?
Perfectionist.
Thank you. You guys are good. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and sometimes the guys would. I was just like, you know, could we do that again? And they would hear something in it, and they'd say, no, we can't do it again. This is the one. This is it. And me, in my back of my mind, I'm just like, what you hear is perfection. What I'm hearing is me cringing in 5 years' time at a recording that we just didn't get right. That's what I'm hearing. And it's taken me a long time to actually listen back to those recordings and hear all of those imperfections and place them in the realms of the emotional content of that particular point in time, which I find is missed from a lot of music right now. I think there is no emotional connectivity. I think there's amazing recordings, and there's that's why I'm sorry to digress. I'm into Tyler, the Creator. I love Tyler, the Creator, because that's Tyler, the Creator. He's basically, you're going to get what you're going to get. This is it. You like it? Great. If you don't like it, tough shit. You can get the bows at. I don't really care. No big deal. That's him. But that was us back in the day. That was our approach to doing things. We were just like, oh my God, we think this sounds amazing. And I was like, oh, but I want perfection. And they were like, but can't you hear it? This is our perfection. This is ours, not anyone else's perfection. This is our perfection. And you know, I had to concede ground a lot. And admittedly, the boys, especially Pete and Carl and Mick and John, they were right and I was wrong. And you know, it's not very often that I'm wrong. Yeah.
So what do you remember about the reaction to it when it came out? Fans and critics went down well, right?
Well, the one thing was, I think we were already on the cover of the NME magazine before the album even came out. Mm. So I think there was already kind of like a preconceived kind of rush to actually hear the album, purely on the basis of the fact that people were of the opinion that we were supposed to be part shit. Luckily, it didn't go against us. It could have totally gone against us. It could have totally gone the other way. I mean, we could have really, really just been kicked in the ass because of that. But it didn't. People just kind of like went along with it. And a lot of it is a testament to the characters of Pete and Carl. Because you know, as time has gone by, the stories of woe with reference to their patriarch, their friendship, their whatever, it's kind of like become stuff of legends. And it is because their relationship, albeit fraught at times, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. I mean, even to this day, I mean, it's not as audiosyncratic as it used to be, but it still has a flavor that I haven't seen anywhere else. There's pretenders to the throne with reference to the way that, you know, you can finish off somebody's sentences. Perfect example of that. I know I'm waffling on, but that's what I do. I'm a waffler. That's what I do. I waffle. And we're moving forward a few years. We did the David Letterman show. and we got to 48th and 8th to the studios. John was meeting family and friends. Pete and Carl, they decided they were going to go on an adventure. I knew the neighborhood. I used to get dropped off at 42nd and 8th all of the time by my grandmother to go see friends in Queens, blah, blah, blah. So like, I don't want to walk around because I know where everything is around here anyway. I don't really care. So I went to the dressing room, stood in the dressing room and who was it? There was a band playing across the street. What were they called again? Was it Das Effects? I can't remember. No, it wasn't Das Effects. It was a big emo rock band, but I can't remember what they were called. They were playing across the street, and there were loads of fans there, and I was bored shitless. Then there was a bowl of fruit on the table in front of me, so I opened up the window and I started throwing fruit out at people on the streets, because I wouldn't be able to see where it's coming from, so I'm just throwing fruit. And whilst I'm doing this, David Letterman, he walks by, and he sees me doing it, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like caught red-handed. Oh, throw fruit. Oh, Jesus. And he comes into the room, says hi, picks up some fruit, throws it out of the window himself. He walks by. I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. I'm causing trouble with David Letterman. That's pretty awesome. I then later on met him again, went to meet his mom, went to his dressing room, hung out with David Letterman. It was really, really cool. Coming back from that, I was going back up to the dressing room. And as I got to the top of the stairs, I saw Pete and Carl. And they were walking back into the dressing room, but they were looking a little bit kind of suspicious. They'd obviously been up to something. Now, we were there on a Thursday. Letterman used to record two shows on a Thursday because he never worked on a Friday. Our show was going out on a Friday. On the Thursday, the live show that evening was Marilyn Manson. So as I came up the stairs and saw Pete and Carl, Marilyn Manson and his security were walking right by Pete and Carl. And they walked, and he literally walked right by them with his security. And Pete and Carl just stood there and just kind of edged around and looked at him. He got into the elevator. Pete and Carl looked at each other and just went. And I was like, uh-oh, what's going on here? And the elevator went down the stairs, and they literally just hot-footed him all the way down the stairs, ran downstairs, and waited at the bottom of the stairs for the elevator doors to open up. And I just kind of stood by the bottom of the stairs, just kind of looking like, what the hell are you guys doing? What are you doing? And then all of a sudden the elevator doors opened up, and Marilyn Manson kind of stood there looking like the son of the devil, the dark lord of the Sith, whatever, just kind of stood there. And Pete Carr just looked at him and just went, and Marilyn Manson just pissed himself laughing. He just pissed himself laughing. It was hilarious. It was just literally the funniest thing. And all the time running down the stairs, they never mentioned anything. They didn't say a word. They didn't say what they were going to do. They literally just nodded at each other and just went, that was it. And they knew exactly what they were going to do. And then just waited at the bottom of the stairs. And Marilyn Manson pissed himself laughing. It was the funniest thing. It was really, really funny. So they had their sense of hilarity, their sense of brotherhood is a driving force behind everything that we are. And then that kind of like, that almost dictates the emotional delivery of everything that we do as well. And I know that that's a massive factor in why people are into what we do. It's not just the music. It can never be just the music. It's always about the emotional delivery of the music, the emotional characters behind the music, whether you believe it or not, you sing along to a song because you believe the words that are being delivered to you. And they have an emotional connection to you because of the person that's delivering those words. Very rarely do we sing a song or learn the words to a song and then repeat them 5 years later after never hearing that song in that period of time without having some kind of an emotional connection to the music and the person that's delivered that song. That's just kind of obvious, really. So there's definitely a weird emotional connectivity between the two of them that hasn't been matched.
Yeah, definitely. Such a fascinating relationship they've got. But yeah, it's interesting what you were saying there, because certainly for me as well, you feel like you're, certainly back in that time, around that release of that first album, you feel like you're part of your world, the band's world. You
Yeah.
There was obviously lots of chat on internet forums. You know, I remember reading the interviews in NME or wherever, and you sort of become engrossed in this other world that you guys appear to be living in, and of this sort of, I say, messing around, scaring Marilyn Manson or playing these crazy gigs at flats or on whatever venues in London. And it was just, just buying into that world and, escaping into that libertines, feeling part of the band almost.
Yeah. I mean, specifically within the realms of music, at that particular point in time, a lot of characters were losing their kind of like their individualism with reference to their connection to the audience. If you look at if you look at artists now, it's all very kind of like, I don't know, it's very plain. There is no real connection. We utilize social media and social media platforms as a way of disguising our initial or our real intent of communication. We hide behind it. Instead of actually properly communicating, we'll take a nice picture. We'll stand with somebody cool. That's cool. And everyone will go, wow, look at the whip. Look where they are. That's amazing. But there's nothing there. But that's not it. That's not interesting. That's not really interesting. That's fleeting. That's a fleeting moment. There's nothing there that grabs your imagination. One of the only true artists, unfortunately, that grabs people's imaginations right now, unfortunately for the wrong reasons, is Kanye. Kanye is out, completely out of there. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of it is to do with the bipolar, mental health, family, blah, blah, all of the rest of it, the loss of his mother, all of the rest of it. But that hasn't stopped him voicing his opinions about what he wants to do and the person who he wants to be. And there isn't anybody doing that. There isn't any. Lewis Capaldi's not doing it. And everybody loves Lewis Capaldi. Lewis Capaldi comes in on stage and he's a funny guy. And he's just a funny guy. He's like, hey, I'm a funny, funny guy. I'm a funny chap. I'm a funny guy. But yeah, you're funny. But that's cool. He's possibly the closest thing to a character outside of the realms of what is popular music right now. Coldplay ain't characters. Who else? There's no characters. There is none. Where are the characters? I'd say John Reverend, definitely a character. He's a character. He's definitely a northern stronghold of characters all by himself. But I can't think of anybody of any major influence that's actually doing anything in the realms of imagination, in the realms of not even I want to be like that. I just like, oh my God, did they just do that? Did they say that? Did they? Oh my God, that's amazing. I actually completely agree with them. There is nobody like that, because everybody's too busy trying to toe the lines of conventionality, as far as I'm concerned, it's partially killing the industry. And I think it's partially the death of what was indie music. You know, that and the flooding of the scene with all artists trying to be like every single other artist out there. But there was no individualism. There was no individuality. There's nobody for the average person on the street buying the music to say, I want to be like that. Because every single artist within the genre was trying to be like every other single artist within the genre. So the genre just got flooded. You go to an indie night now and there'll be a DJ on, and three quarters of the DJ set beforehand will be played by the DJ that's following next, because there's only so much indie music. Because we kind of like shot ourselves in the foot with reference to individuality. Because everybody wanted to be conventional, everybody wanted to be accepted. Fuck being accepted, do your thing.
Yeah, I think it really does.
And that's kind of what we did. We were just like black guy playing rock. The amount of people when we started playing, white and black people would come up to me and go, why are you in this band? This makes no sense whatsoever. Well, I'm really, really sorry to tell you this, but black people invented rock and roll. Not white people, black people did that. So if anybody should be on the stage, it's me. But regardless of that, why? What's the thing? Don't you want individuality? Don't you want to look at something new and fresh and go, wow, that's amazing. Isn't that cool? And then we have the advent of the likes of Block Party with their new and fresh approach and blah, blah, blah. You know, it just, but there just was, there's just not enough of it. There's just not, I don't know where I don't know how I ended up here, but there's a reason for it.
Yeah, absolutely. That debut album then, Gary, I think, you know, you're absolutely right in terms of the bond with the fans, the characters of the band, you know, really did set them apart of being a, you know, really special band. But, you know, that debut album just turned 18 last month. You know, what are your reflections on it now? You know, I think me and Pete, with lots of your fans, would single it out as one of the most important albums of that decade, of that era, really earned its place in history. So what are your reflections on it 18 years later?
To be honest, up until, you know, till Tim Burgess did his listening party, I hadn't listened to that album in God knows how many years. It had completely flown by me. And even wrongly from my point of view, whenever we played things live from that album, my approach was to get it as right as possible, And I'd forgotten all about the emotional connection with the original performance of the music. I'd completely forgotten about that. My thing was, let's just play this right. Let's just play it right and get it down. That's kind of, on stage, that was always my thing. It's just like, I'm going to lock this down as much as I possibly can do to give you guys the room to do your thing. If I'm like steadfast and sure and assured, then that gives you guys room to fuck something up. It gives you guys room to kind of like experiment and goof around with the guitar and kick a mic stand down and not get completely lost within the music, because you know I'm not following you. You can do whatever you want on stage and I'm going to be here. So you can always fall back into what I'm doing. It's just going to be completely fine. That was always my thing to kind of do that. But because I did that, I lost all connection with the first album. And it was when we did the listening party with Tim Burgess, and I had and I was just like kind of like listening, had my headphones on, listening, and just kind of like talking to people on Twitter about certain tracks and what we did within those tracks, all of those things, and I'd replaced that whole original sentiment with not even trying to perform my best for the audience, with trying to play it as best as I possibly could do, so that the stage show would be okay. You know what I mean? It's kind of weird, because obviously I have to perform to the best of my ability. You know, we should all want to do that. People are paying a lot of money to turn up to a show. If they don't want to see a half-ass show, they want to see the best you can give every single time. But it has to be, in my mind, it has to be within the framework of the original intent. So people do have something that they can actually go, yeah, I can lean on that. I'm not just singing along to a song that I know. I'm singing along to a song that's from my past and brings back emotional connectivity to the past. You know, like when you're listening to the radio or driving somewhere and a song comes on that you haven't heard in ages and you get that sudden rush, you're like, oh, I haven't heard that in ages. Sometimes you well up a little bit because it takes you back to a real particular point in time. And you're like, oh, wow, that's amazing. I completely forgot, you know, that's for me, I kind of lost that within live performances. That whole, everything that we do is emotionally driven. And I replaced that with being as succinct and as perfect as I possibly could be within the framework of the tracks that we were playing. So I don't know how we got there again. How did we get there?
Yeah, no, it's interesting sort of, yeah, your relationship with that album, how that's changed. Cool. Well, let's talk about the second album in a minute, Gary. We're going in part two. We'll jump onto The Libertines and talk about what came next.
Cool them again. How you guys doing? I'm Gary from The Libertines, and you are listening to The Boys in the Band Podcast.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know, sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
Okay. Welcome back to the Boys in the Band podcast, where we're joined by Libertines drummer Gary Powell, who's just trying not to think about Arsenal at the moment. Gary, it's been a fun ride through the debut album, but it gets a bit wild from here on. Pete and Carl's relationship obviously gets a bit strained. We know Pete ends up in prison after breaking into Carl's flat. And the question for you, really, Gary, from us is, you know, how was it for you and John when, you know, the media attention is just ramping up, especially on Pete? and you guys are just like seeing this all going on around you. What's it like to be in that band at that time?
It was really, really tough. It the fun from performing had it had dissipated. It had completely gone. And to be honest, it had lost the drive, lost the fervor for a while now. When we went into the studio to record the second album, by this point in time, we'd started to be managed by Alan McGee and his business partner, Stephen King. And I remember I remember meeting Alan for the first time at Reading and Leeds, in Reading, the first time we performed there, and talking to him about the possibilities of him managing us. And primarily, and before that, Carl, he'd actually seen Alan, and he'd mentioned it to Alan as well. It's good because Alan mentioned that to me directly afterwards, and he said, "Yeah, why don't we kind of like have a chat about that at some stage, and let's arrange a meeting." So we'd played the festivals, we did Top of the Pops as well, or something like that. I was at that point in time, we were still riding the crest of a wave. I think we were number three in the charts, done massive festivals, just completed the US tour. I was still absolutely penniless. I went into a Sainsbury's to do some shopping with a bag shitload of shopping. Went up to pay for it all. I didn't have any money at all. The embarrassment of having to leave it there and then not even being able to get on the bus to go home. I had to walk all the way home. It was just like the worst feeling in the world for me at that particular point in time. And that primarily for me, as far as I was concerned, was because of mismanagement. So I was really, really happy to get rid of management and get rid of everything with reference to do with the first album. Not the first album, not the music, not the guys in the band, but just everything behind that. Just like, as far as I was concerned, they're like, adios. I don't want to see you guys no more. I'm gone. And Carl was of the same frame of mind as well. And because Carl and Pete were pretty much idiosyncratic about everything, you know, Pete was definitely alone. And so that meant John was as well. So we started being managed by Alan McGee, and things kind of like changed for a while. Alan did his best to kind of like really kind of steady the ship as much as he possibly could do. But, you know, we were definitely on a steady decline at that point in time, you know, so... And one of the things that Alan thought might be able to steady the ship for a while would be for us to do a second album. So we had a bunch of meetings about going into the studio and doing the second album. But and once we actually agreed it and we got the studio time, we got the studio booked, and the day arrived and we went to the studio. Obviously by now, we've recorded in a professional studio beforehand. And albeit this was a different one, this was Metropolis in Chiswick. We arrived at the studio, we got driven there, you know, beforehand, when we recorded at Rack for the first album, I got the bus to the studio. I got up in the morning, got up really early, got almost packed sandwiches. And I'm just like, but this studio is going to be amazing. This time around, there's a car waiting for me at home. I jump into the car, I kind of sit in the back. I'm just kind of like, studio, I wonder what this is going to be like. I walk into the studio. I'm just like, hi guys, how you doing? You know, it's just kind of, you know, almost retarded. I mean, because it's still an amazing feat to be able to go into a professional studio and record a professional album in a professional studio with professional musicians in a professional setting. But we're all kind of like, we're all old hats at it now. But we walk into the studio and we have security stood either side of the studio. And it's security of it with you. It's Mick and Jeff, the twins, really huge Samoan-looking twins, smoked cigars, tattoos all over them. Great guys, loved hanging out with them. Always on point regarding what we're doing, and didn't let us get away with much. Really didn't let us get away with much at all. They all stood either side of the studio. We're like, what the hell are you guys doing here? And, you know, we get everything set up for us now. I'm not rushing around setting up drums. It's all being set up for us. And then Mick Jones, he eventually arrives with Bill. And they're like, and, you know, we have a little chat and stuff. And then Bill says, right, let's get started. What are you going to play? And we went, oh, play. Mm-hmm. We'd spent so much time going over the logistics of getting us into the studio. We'd forgotten that we had no material. So that whole that was the whole of the second album. The whole second album was like taking little bits of things from left, right, and center, putting them together, writing live in the studio at that particular point in time. I remember things like Don't Be Shy was Pete's. We sat around at lunchtime and Pete just started like just singing, "No, be shy." And I started laying down a groove, and all of a sudden we had the remnants of something. We just dived straight back into the studio, and that's why it sounds as it sounds. You know, I don't know if you've listened to it recently, but there's a few places where it sounds like we're going to maybe start something else, but we actually go into something else altogether. It looks like it's going to go this way, but it goes this way. That's because we were literally rehearsing it, learning it, and recording it all at the same time. That was the second album. So the second album, with reference to the first album, had a completely different dynamic. The dynamic was completely different, but it was still just as emotionally charged because we were really, really fighting hard. Time was against us. By this point in time, Peter was kind of like, let's just say he was well within the grips. He was well within the grips of his addiction. He was trying really, really hard, but he was still well within the grips of his addiction. So we had a very limited time slot in order to get as much done as we possibly could do. And to be honest, we achieved what we achieved in the time slot that we had. And to the level that we actually achieved it as well was pretty phenomenal. It was a lot of hard work by everybody involved. And we still enjoyed it as well. It was a fun endeavor. We had a great time. There was a bar in the studio as well. And a pool table. Amy came down sometimes as well. Ed Harcourt, he'd come down and pop down and just kind of hang out in the studio and stuff. And we'd have a few games of pool. We'd just kind of goof around at the bar. At the end of the bar, they had every day there was a bottle of whiskey there for me with my name on it, so that nobody would touch my whiskey. So I'd just literally just turn up and just wave to the barman and just start pouring me whiskey. We just start knocking them back. It was a tough environment to be in. But it was definitely a worthwhile environment, especially considering when the album was released. I remember going to the gym one day and then going into HMV. Remember HMV? I was living by myself in a flat in Hackney, which I'm still living in now. I'm not in the same flat, but then I was living in a little flat in Hackney. And I wanted to buy a film to watch that evening. And I walked into HMV and I just heard the album playing. And then I looked up and it just had this big thing, Libertine's number one album. And I just stood there and looked at it and was like, whoa. And then just kind of looked around and thought, nobody knows. Oh, cool. And I literally just walked around the H&B listening to the whole album in that environment and just kind of like watching people's kind of like reactions, watching how, what, you know, some people were kind of bubbling along. Some people were paying no attention, which is fine, which is totally fine. But it was still really, really cool. It was a very, very cool experience. But coupled with the whole kind of like weird experience of recording that album and then listening to people's kind of like, I think Mick Jones received, a producer's credit for it as well. Like almost like an Ivor Novello for best album produced. It wasn't an Ivor Novello, but he received accolades for the production on that album. And it was basically a demo. That's all it was. It was basically a demo. That's all we had time to do. We had no time for nothing else. It was like, literally just like, one done, moving on to the next track.
Amazing.
There definitely must have been that that urge to get it sorted, because I just felt like at that point, Libertines had been on such a fast rise. You know, after that debut album, you were thrust into the limelight, doing so many shows, all the stuff in the news about Pete and Carl and prison and things and, you know, that. The infamous gig at the Tap and Tin in Chatham on the day that Pete came out, NME called it one of their gigs of the year. You know, it seemed like you were really riding the crest of a wave at that time. You had to really capitalize.
Yeah. I think a lot of that was more press speculation than ability and agility of the band. I think the crest of a wave was actually created for the press, mainly by the press, so that they could actually utilize everything that we were doing in order to sell more column inches for them. That's all. That's what that was, which heaped a hell of a lot of pressure on us, unbeknownst to us at that particular point in time, because we were literally, as you said, just riding the crest of a wave. But it was definitely a heady period of time for us, especially regarding the relationship with Pete and Carl. I mean, I remember we had to play some shows in the States, and prior to that, I think we just played Rock and Ring on Rock and Park, and And that was the shows when Peter decided that he wasn't going to be with the, he wasn't going to play those shows. And I think because he decided that he wasn't going to play those shows, I think in his mind, albeit warts because of the chemical imbalance, let's just put it like that, I think he assumed that we weren't going to play those shows as well, because he said he wasn't going to do it. We just weren't going to do it. But unfortunately, even if we wanted to, we couldn't just do that. Because if we decided that we weren't going to play those shows, we would have got sued and lost everything. We hadn't earned a great deal at that point in time. So like from this being sued by Rock and Ring and Rock and Pop, who are operating individually as two separate entities, both of them, they would have cleaned me out. I would have been absolutely broke, penniless. Same for Carl, same for John. That would have been that. So we had no choice but to kind of like commit to whatever was placed in front of us at that point in time. And because we committed to those shows, that meant we had no choice but to commit to the American shows that had already been pre-booked and already been prepaid. We had to do them. There was no choice in the matter. We couldn't write a doctor's note because everybody knew what was going on. And at that point in time, it was like, what do you mean? We've paid for this. You three can play. Figure it out, basically. You've got no choice in the matter. Figure it out. We're not like letting you guys get off with this. So we had no choice but to play them. So luckily for us, we managed to rope in Anthony Rosamondo, who then joined Dirty Pretty Things. He lived with me in my flat in Hackney. And we just taught him the music. And we did the American shows. And then we went off to Japan. And we did the Japanese tour, which was a fitting ending. Because by the time we finished the Japanese tour, everybody, we were getting on like a house on fire. It was fun. It was, I'd say, nearly as fun as the first few shows that we started playing as the Libertines. Because by then, by the time we got to Japan, it was like the pressure was off. It was like, well, we've only got these shows to play. So why don't we just have the best time that we possibly can do? And it was just hilarious. And I remember like the bus ride back to the airport to fly from Narita Noba back to London, and the crew and the band were all drinking in the bus and everybody's goofing around. And we had these weird seats that we could like kind of like sit. You could either sit a bus with everybody behind each other, or you could flip the seats around and everybody could face each other. And we were just like goofing around in the seats, just being big kids and just goofing around, just drinking as much as we possibly could do. And then by the time we got on the plane, we carried on drinking. By the time we landed in London, it wasn't even post security. It was whilst we were on the runway, that Carl got the call from his sister that his flat had been broken into. And it just brought everything back down to earth with a massive bump. And I just remember feeling, I was just like, the irony of us landing like that, and then Pete, and then Carl getting the phone call that he'd been burgled by his best friend. The irony was just, it was just uncanny. It was just uncanny. But we still managed to fight through it. And a lot of that is a testament. A lot of that's a testament to Carl. To Carl's tenacity, to Carl's guile, to Carl's understanding of the scenario. John and I, what we try to, I kind of like am the devil's advocate at the best of times with everything. Carl is very kind of like steadfast. He's become very, very steadfast, and he's become very, very driven in his approach to everything that he wants to do now. And he's, like the hotel, for instance. The hotel is Carl. That's Carl's baby. He came up with the idea, and he's been the one person out of all of us that has been really, really working to drive the hotel home. That's Carl. I worked in the studio, got all of the studio gear sorted out, but then because of other things, I just wasn't able to do so, and just let Carl do it. Carl was happy to do it. Carl wants us to join in and help, but Carl's just like, if you ain't helping, I'm doing this. That's the new Carl. That's who Carl is right now. That's the Carl. And that is because of his relationship with Peter. If there's one thing that Carl can actually take out of everything that's happened in the past, is to not give up, to keep on driving for it. He didn't give up on his friend at all. He got pissed off with him, but he understood. He was just like, that's not him. He knew who Peter was. He knows who Peter is. And because he knows who he is, because he knew who he was, he's never going to give up on him, no matter what. And sometimes I think, that's because of the world that we live in today, we find it all too easy to give up on things. Most people have a job for 2 years, move on to the next job. Blah, blah, blah. There's no kind of like long-term plan you know, you think we have a relationship, we get out the relationship, blah, blah, blah. I can't be bothered, but I'll see you later. I don't like your cooking. Bye. Your breath smells, actually. We find excuses not to follow through. I'm not saying everybody, that, you know, that would be a generalization to say everybody's like that, but you know, that can be a common trait within certain aspects of our lives in its entirety. You know, we all, I mean, I know I do. I'll give up on something very, very easily without even thinking about it, because it's become commonplace to give up on things. If I don't want to do something, I'm just not going to do it. But Carl, within these certain things, he's just been like, yeah, I'm driven. And because of that, you know, we were able, you know, he was definitely one of the driving forces in being able to get through the second album and post that as well, even to this point right now. You know, Carl is, you know, it fathoms me why, when people talk about the relationship between the two of them, everybody always says Pete and Carl. When alphabetically, it is actually Carl and Pete. It is Carl and Peter, and it should be Carl and Peter. That's in my mind. That's the way that I see it. It's Carl and Peter. Peter is, and that is not even me taking anything away from Peter being the enigmatic, charming, emotionally charged, artistic laureate, poet laureate that he is. He's amazing. But all of that becomes magnified when he's around Carl. That the magnification of that is intense when he has Carl to work off. But Carl by himself, Carl's like, this is it. He played me some stuff that the last time we was in Margaret, he played me some stuff that he's been writing, and it's brilliant. It is brilliant. Peter will bring an idea and we'll work on it. Peter will bring an idea and say, I've got an idea, let's work on it. Carl will bring a track and go, hey, what do you think? So as far as I'm concerned, it's Carl and Peter. But that's not taking anything away from Peter. I wouldn't do that to Peter, and I wouldn't do that to people who are lovers of Peter's work, of the body of work that he's done, because even that is still amazing. And again, that just goes to the relationship and how, I don't know, let's just say it, how brilliant the two of them actually are. Yeah. You know, individually, together, the ensemble put all together, you know, with them two at the front, it's pretty special.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously that bond sort of held them together for so long, but by the end of 2004, you've been touring without Pete for a while, and the band decided to call a split at that point. So how difficult was that? And what were your feelings about it at the time?
It was really easy. It just needed to happen. It really needed to happen. It was just very, very easy. You know, Peter, at that point in time, when we were playing shows already and doing shows, he was already starting to kind of like mention Baby Shambles doing shows. He was always like singing Baby Shambles in his mind. That's what he was doing next. He was already there, and we hadn't even finished playing shows as the Libertines yet, but his mind is already moving on to the next phase of what he wanted to do, which is completely fine. So when we eventually did kind of split, the first thing I did was go into the studio with Peter, and we started recording early Baby Shambles stuff. It was fine, because we have to remember, regardless of like the press manipulation of the scenario, we hadn't fallen out. None of us had fallen out. There was no massive problem. Peter, as far as I was concerned, and I hope I'm not wrong about this, he didn't have a problem with me. Carl and Peter, they had a problem with the scenario, but they didn't have a problem with each other. They just couldn't work with the way things were. And John was just like, hey, Ben, you know, I'm here. I'm here. There wasn't a massive problem. So for me to then start working with Pete, and we went into a studio in Shoreditch off Redchurch Street. And we spent a few days just knocking out ideas. And it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And then after that, John came and he was just like, starting Yeti. Yep. Do you want to start doing some stuff? And I was just like, yeah, sure, let's do it. So I started working with John at Yeti. We played a show at the 12 bar in Denmark Street. And yeah, you know, it was great. We did a little bit of recording. Yeah, it was great. And then Carl, we'd already decided that we were going to do something. And then all of a sudden, I went in the studio with Carl. And we just carried on, and all of a sudden Dirty Pretty Things was formed. And but by that point in time, Peter had already set up Baby Shambles. John had his Yeti formed and ready to go. Me and Carl, by that point, were doing Dirty Pretty Things. And it was the most important step that all four of us needed to make at that particular point in time. That because time apart was so important for us, albeit it was a lot more elongated than I actually thought it should have been. But that time apart for us to actually get away from each other and not think about what had happened, not think about where we were, not think about what we had done, just think about what we were doing, where we were at that particular point in time, and what the trajectory was going to be for all of us at that particular point in time. So that when we actually did see each other, you know, we wouldn't see each other with any form of animosity or anything like that. I remember I was DJing, I did a DJ show for Hedy Slimane. He did his menswear collection in, my phone is just going off the hook. he did a menswear collection in Paris, and he asked me to come DJ for him. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll DJ for him. And Pete was seeing Kate Moss, and at the after show thing, everybody was there, and I saw Pete, and we had a good old chat, and it was a really good catch up. It wasn't like, oh, it's you. It was like, oh, what are you doing? I had no idea you were being here. I had no idea you were going to be here. It was really, really good to see him. And hopefully he would feel the same way about me at that particular point in time as well. And then I remember going to see John play with Yeti. And it was like great seeing his, damn, my phone, shut up. And then seeing Yeti play and that was, it was great seeing them play and meeting his new band and enjoy. And obviously I enjoyed playing for the brief time that we did with Dirty Pretty Things. And, you know, it was what we needed for us to actually be able to say, okay, maybe now's time for us to actually get back together. Because once we actually did get back together, that we'd learned so much about ourselves as individuals and what we wanted from the industry and what we wanted from ourselves and the people that were around us, that it made it really, really easy for us to just go, okay, then, hey, how you doing? Let's maybe have a look, see at what we could possibly do together, but have it be on all of our terms, as opposed to it being a forced agenda by anybody else or anything else. Let's just see what's going to happen.
Yep, it's a third album, third chapter. We didn't always think we were going to get Gary, but we did. So in part three, we're going to chat about the long-awaited reunion album number three and what's next for the Libertines as well.
You're listening to the Boys in the Band podcast. For more noughties nostalgia, check out our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram pages, and make sure you hit subscribe to the podcast for more interviews like this. All right, welcome back to this third and final part of our special Libertines episode with the one and only Gary Powell. So Gary, after that split in 2004, it was a long time before we saw you all back together again. We got a rare glimpse of the band back together at Reading and Leeds in 2010. Then back again at Hyde Park in 2014 and the Ali Pally shows too. Absolutely incredible gigs. And as fans, it was so special to have you all back on stage together. It seemed so unlikely for all those years in between. So what was it that brought you back together? What convinced you all that the Libertines needed to reunite?
I initially got a phone call from Pete's manager. I can't remember what his name was. He was a dickhead anyway. I couldn't stand him. And he called me up, and this was literally, a few months before my missus, before we had my first son, Wolf. So my missus is heavily pregnant. I've moved on. I've been DJing everywhere around the world. I've got my own little project going on as well as working with Carl. So I'm kind of busy. I'm doing things. I'm now getting into the world of writing music for brands. I'm writing music for fashion brands. I'm doing fashion shows. I'm doing lots and lots of different things. So at that point in time, I'm just like the Libertines. I'm like, you know, if we do something, I don't care. I'm making a living. I'm all right. If it was for the money, you know, I would have dived at it. But, it's just like, if they didn't call at that point in time, it would have been no biggie for me. I'm fine. I was working with Adam Fychek. We're doing London Guns. We're touring the world doing that as well. So I'm just like, I'm busy doing. I've got, I've, as far as I'm concerned, I got it covered. I'm fine. I'm all right. I'm doing good. I'm all right. And but then this dude called us up and he was just like, yeah, yeah, you know what I'm calling about. And I knew he was Jake Fjord. Was it Jake Fjord? I can't remember what his name was. And I'm like, yeah, all right, cool. And he said, we should meet. And he didn't turn up to the meeting and he pissed me off. He made me go to the meeting, but he didn't turn up. He didn't, so he pissed me off. So my initial thought was like, you know, fuck that guy. I'm not interested in any of that bullshit anymore. I'm just not interested. If the guys want to contact me, then that's fine. But if not, whatever. Then Carl's manager at that point in time, Dave Bianchi, this is maybe a couple of months later, he called us up and went, got something you might be interested in. Carl wants to know. And but by this time, he actually said Carl. Whereas beforehand, this Jake dude or whatever his name was just like, I want to talk to you about like the prospect of the Libs getting back together, blah, 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 the rest of it. But Bianchi called us up and he's just like, Carl wants to know if you're interested in a little reunion with the boys. And I went, well, obviously, yeah, of course I am. That'd be very cool. I haven't seen him in ages. That'd be cool. And initially that's what it was. It was a meeting. It was us catching up. It was, and we met at a pub in West London and we just sat in the corner and we had a good old chat. And that's where it all began. It started with us all being in a room together, as opposed to beforehand with this dude, I want to talk to you about a Libertines reunion. I like fell for it and then got pissed off because the dude didn't even turn up. But when it actually came to the possibility of us all being in the room together and catching up and just to see how everybody was doing, because we were all leading separate lives at that particular point in time. I think John by then had moved to Denmark. I went to his wedding party and then he moved to Aarhus and, you know, and he hadn't had a kid yet, but he was leading a happy life in Denmark by himself. He was more than happy. Carl was not living too far away from me, but he'd released a solo album. So he was doing stuff himself. I just released a solo album and I was doing, but we had, none of us had seen each other. We had no idea what any of us were actually doing. We'd heard what we were doing. We'd maybe even read what we were all doing individually, but we hadn't really that emotional connectivity that actually brought us all together in the first place. That was completely missing. That was devoid from the relationship. So for us to actually have the opportunity to actually get back together again and just kind of sit down and have a chat and see how things were going. We did that. And it literally was just like catching up from maybe seeing each other a week before. The path of the conversations hadn't changed. It was still a piss take. It was still I ended up turning up late because I had things to do, and we hadn't seen each other in about 10 years at that point in time. And instead of just kind of like being PC and being like, oh, really good to see you, Gary, but what the rest of it, maybe saying something slaggy amongst themselves whilst I wasn't there, they just went straight in for it. They just went straight in and it was like, no, fuck you. And it was hilarious. It was just like, it literally was just like just taking off from where we left off in the first place, which for me just kind of like it sealed the deal with reference to us playing together again. Because by then, remember, the only thing that was stopping us playing together was the fact that there was a ghost in the room. The ghost in the room being Pete's addiction. But at that point in time, the addiction didn't seem to be a problem. The addiction was in the room next door. And the only people in that room at a particular point in time was Pete, Carl, John, and myself. Or should I say, Carl, Pete, John, and myself.
Good callback. So older, wiser, but still obviously got that bond. And you take that into writing and recording for Anthems for Doomed Youth. And this was done out in Thailand, right?
Yes, it was. It was done in a little seafaring town called Bang Sarai, which was about 2 hours kind of southeast of Bangkok. Beautiful little place. The studio was called Karma Sound Studio. It was run by a guy called Chris Cracker, who is Hans Zimmer's business partner. Is amazing because I got the opportunity to just like ship out a bunch of gear with me. And I set up a studio in my room because it was a residential studio. Man, it was oh my God, it was gorgeous. If the phone went now, oh, 1 second, and somebody said, get on a plane, you're going back to Karma Sounds tomorrow, I'd literally be hanging up now, packing it up. Karma Sounds was just amazing. And the irony is, before we went out and I was told that we were going to Thailand to record, I was the one person that put his hand up and said, no, that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Because there was already still, the elephant had raised its hand again. It was back in the room. And there'd been a few problems. And I was just like, if during the duration of the recording process, if there ever is a problem, I don't want to have to fly home after 2 days from Thailand. That's ridiculous. I'd rather get in the car and drive two, three hours from Manchester and be home. I don't want to fly 24 hours from Thailand at a massive expense to get back because we've pissed off the recording process. But everybody just kept on saying, no, it'll be completely fine. We've got a great producer, blah, blah, blah. They did all the rest of it. And I was just like, oh. But because everybody else went along with it, I kind of ended up being badgered into it. And one of the things that allowed me to be seduced into it was the ability for me to actually take a bunch of gear up and set up my own studio whilst I was there as well, which was great. They were like, we'll pay for all your stuff to come out as well. And I was like, seriously? They were like, yeah. I was like, yes, genius. There was literally a beach. We were the studio was in a compound. And the king of Thailand used to record, I think, 4 or 5 jazz albums there a year. He spent time there himself, the king of Thailand. That's how good the studio was. The control room was based on Olympia Studios. The live room was based, no, other way around. The live room was based on the Olympia Studios. The control room was based on Metropolis that we recorded at in London, which was amazing. So we walked in and there was a familiarity there already, but we were in Thailand and the weather was gorgeous. There was a beach, 200 meters down the road, which I never went to once because I had my studio. We had this pool. I'd wake up every morning and go for a swim with a chef cooking for us, this woman called Eat, and the food was amazing. And when we didn't eat at that studio, we'd walk down the street to the beach and there was a little kind of like seaside thing. And there was a seafood restaurant called what was it called again? It wasn't called Wankies, but it had a name like that. It was something like Hand Job, you know, something. It was a name that was derogative of, and you would think that with a name like that you would constantly take the piss. But we went there and we spent so little money on food. And the food was more amazing than any of us had ever tasted because it was so fresh. There were people driving 2-3 hours from Bangkok down to come to this particular restaurant. And they treated us really cool because we were at the studio 200 meters away, which was frequented by the king of Thailand. So they looked after us. We didn't have to, they didn't give us any food for free because they didn't need to, because it was that cheap. The food was amazing. That was where we were ensconced for the duration of the time that we were there. It was amazing. And the whole recording process, which I thought would be a problem because I'd recorded an album by myself. So I had an ideology as to how I wanted to work. Carl had recorded his own solo album. I'd worked with John. I knew John had a different approach to recording. And Peter, he'd recorded Baby Shambles albums and done Baby Shambles singles. Him and I was just like, this is going to be an absolute fuckfest of people and their opinions wanting to fight over it, blah, blah, all of the rest of it. And it just wasn't. It just wasn't. It just slotted back into place again as it had done beforehand. But this time with a fresh ideology as to what we could actually achieve. The only thing for me that kind of lets it down is, by no fault of anybody, I mean, I should have just spoken up at the time, was the overall sound of the album. I just think it sounds too polished. It sounds a little bit too smooth. I wish I would have kind of like, I don't know, poured milk over the desk or something. You know, because the tracks are there, it's an amazing sound. It's an amazingly well-written album. because we all worked on it together. It was us again being locked in a room together and working on things. And whenever we had a problem, I'll tell you what it was like. Sorry, it's me waffling again. It was like, the Beatles' White Album. Famously, when they wrote that album, there were two studios set up. There's a main studio that they worked, and then there was another little studio next to it where they'd kind of like just iron out ideas or come up with new fresh ideas. There's a piano in there, a microphone, a guitar, and a little recording desk, and they'd just record ideas in there. Then they'd take, it was literally like Fordism. It would start here, it would end up in there, and it would all be finished there, but all the rest of it. Well, we took it one step further. I had my studio in my room up there. Then there was another little studio here that Pete and Carl could go into and do the things. Then we had the main studio where we did everything in there. And if we had a problem with anything that we had in the main studio, I'd take it up to my little studio and I'd goof around and we'd mess around with things. And then John would come up with me and we'd tinker with it and we'd come up with another idea. We'd take it back down to the little studio. Pete and Carl would then write around that little thing and then we'd take it back into the main studio. And it was just great. It was a really, really good working environment. It was a great working experience. And it taught us a lot, again, about having a sense of faith and a sense of understanding of each of everyone's abilities with reference to what we did. Whereas beforehand, when we did the first album, especially the first album, it literally was Pete and Carl have got an idea, you guys add to it. This is it, you guys add to it. Whereas now, well, I can't say now because we have ideas now, but we haven't locked anything down concrete yet. And I'm not gonna lie, and so we've got shitloads of stuff. I've written a whole bunch of stuff. And Carl's played me some stuff as well that he's done. I know John's done some stuff because I've recorded John and I would play that John track to you because it is absolutely beautiful. But I'm not gonna.
Oh, I thought we were gonna get an exclusive there. Yeah.
It's a gorgeous track, beautiful track that John's recorded, that John wrote, John sang it, and I'm dying to get John to have that track on the album. That is what I want. I want him to have that track on the album because it's an added dimension to what would be us. It's just an added dimension. But that whole recording experience for the third album was amazing. I just wish we had maybe the sound of the first album and added it to the recording process of the third album, then I think that third album would have been absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Well, you just have to go back to Thailand to try again, won't you, Gary?
Nah.
Gary is nodding. Yeah, just obviously after the release of that album, because fans were obviously so desperate to have you back on stage, but it was amazing to have new music again. And obviously more tours followed, arena tours. And, you know, in the intermittent sort of few years in between then, or since then, I should say, you've done various gigs and most recently the socially distanced gig in Newcastle. What was that like?
That was interesting. It was great, actually. It was great. I mean, apart from the fact that it was absolutely freezing. Bloody cold. It was so cold. I turn up on stage with a woolly hat on, t-shirt and a jacket with hand warmers in my pockets to keep my hands warm. It was so cold. But it was a really interesting experience. It was interesting. The environment for the show in Newcastle had been completely flipped. It was completely different because there was none of the overall camaraderie that would be allowed under normal circumstances, that was completely devoid from the scenario because everybody was in little pods with no more than five or six people in those pods. So at any given time, when you look down from the stage at the audience, what you're generally looking at is a pod of two or three people or a pod of four people. And then you look across and there might be another pod of two people there. There's no connection. It's literally like a massive jigsaw puzzle that has been solved but hasn't been put together. Everything's in the right place, but it just hasn't been joined. It's just all there. That's what it was like. It was a very, very weird experience. And because of that, the one thing that I was worried about prior to it would be the possible lack of connectivity between the audience and the stage, because the audience felt removed from the audience itself, because you've only got your friends there and within your little pod, So it's really, really difficult to have a connection with somebody that's where there's a mass amount of space in between you, and they're not particularly interested in your state of enjoyment because there is that space. You may as well be watching two completely different shows, but it was still fun.
Yeah,
it was still fun. It was still fun because people, I think the one thing that triumphed over it was the human. Well, I don't want to sound like really, really tacky, and I know I'll waffle on a little bit, but it was a triumph of the human spirit of people really, really making an effort to actually, under adversity as well, an effort under adversity. I mean, bearing in mind, this is a global pandemic that we're dealing with now, and countless thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people have died, and even more are actually suffering at this moment in time, and at that moment in time as well. And I'm sure there were audience members who had either lost family or friends at that point in time as well. But what they did was actually quite beautiful. They made the effort to actually rejoin what was left of humanity for what would be the humanity of going to a gig at that point in time. You know, everybody just went, you know something, this is what I like to do, and I'm going to do my best to enjoy it. And they did. They didn't turn up with their fingers crossed. They turned up with an air of anticipation and an air of willingness to actually appreciate what could possibly be the new norm for a while. And yeah, it was an interesting experience. Would I do it again? I'd definitely do it again. It was great.
Yeah,
it was great. I received lots of Twitter messages from people afterwards saying, why would you do that? I mean, I'm going to wait until shows get back to normal. I'm like, for one, we have no idea when shows are going to get back to normal. And for two, in the interim, what are you going to do? Are you just going to watch shows on Zoom? That sounds a lot of fun. Yeah, good luck with that one. Great. Great. When given the opportunity to enter the modern human world, we should all grab it when we can.
Absolutely. We obviously don't really know exactly what the future holds at the moment in terms of when we might get back gigging again. But when we do, Gary, you know, will we get the Libertines back on stage together? And where in the future do you think we might get some new material from you guys?
I'm hoping for new material next year.
Awesome. Oh, cool.
I'm hoping for new material next year, and I'm hoping for us to be playing shows at some stage next year as well. I'm feeling very, very positive about the fact that, because especially with reference to COVID, we have been separated from each other and from any real possibility of, I mean, it'd be quite easy for us to, just like many others have, to write music and send ideas around and everyone play a little bit here and then have that bit recorded and play a little bit there. And it all sounds really, you know, it sounds like lots of people are doing that, which is not taking away from anybody that does that at all. But for me, and I think primarily for us as the Libertines, everything we do is emotionally charged. And I don't think you can do something remotely and send it via the airways and hope to get some kind of like emotional reaction from something that you just can't. A lot of it is about the moment for us. It is about capturing that moment, and not just capturing that moment musically. It's about capturing that moment physically and emotionally, getting the look in the eye from somebody when they've heard something that they really, really like, or you lock into a lyric or you lock into a bit of musical performance, and you're like, oh my God, that's taking me somewhere, and you get taken, and that drives you to create something kind of new from your own standpoint. It may not be new to anybody else, but from your own personal standpoint, you're like, oh my God, I had no idea I was going to go with this, and then you just go somewhere with it. Whereas you can't do that when somebody sends you some stems. you just can't do it. I don't care who you are. You'll come up with a great idea and it'll sound cool. I'm sure it will sound cool. There's many things that I've listened to that I think is amazing. And recently, because I've been watching lots of Zoom videos and Zoom concerts and and the like. But nothing beats a live experience. And I'm personally happy that we have, albeit unthoughtfully, we've decided that we're going to wait until we can actually get back together before we do anything.
Cool. Well, hopefully, fingers crossed, circumstances can play in our favour and we can see you guys back together working on that new material and playing proper shows as we know them and love them. Sometimes
fingers and dicks crossed.
Gary, thanks so much for your time today. It's been brilliant. We've got three more quick fire questions just to round us off.
Hit me. Quick one.
Well, the first one, this is left field, Gary. Cheese rolling contests. Explain. Tell us about your love of cheese rolling contests.
Well, I'm a big love of cheese rolling contests. Because like me and my sister Hope Powell, we get together and we like to do a lot of cheese rolling. What the hell? You know, something that my wiki page, I corrected my wiki page once. I literally took the time, I got into it, and I corrected it. I put as much succinct, correct information on my wiki page as I could do. And then I went back to it the following day and everything was taken off. Everything was taken off there. I got contacted by the BBC when it was the Women's World Cup. On the BBC News, because of Wiki, with Hope Powell, my sister. I ain't never met her before in my life. Never met her.
Down the fake news, dangers Gary. Of Wikipedia. Well, fake news.
Fake news. Fake news.
All right, then. So this certainly isn't fake news, then. So best gig, Gary. Can you pick out the best Libertines gig you've ever played?
Best Libertines gig I've ever played. It might be for me. Can I narrow it down to two?
Go on, then.
Ah, you guys are so funny. One of them would be the very first Japanese show we ever played in Osaka, because we'd been touring with a tour manager called Pete Gunn, and he was getting a little bit annoyed at our antics, setting fights rooms and windows and TVs being thrown out and barred from hotels around the country and the like. And specifically for him, stage invasions. Hated stage invasions. Couldn't stand them. Because he could never quantify exactly what was going to happen on the stage when a shitload of people just managed to jump up on the stage. And we got to Osaka and we were getting ready to play in the afternoon at this festival called Summer Sonic. This must have been about 2003. And it was our first time there. And Pete Gunn, before we went on stage, just went, all right, boys, this is going to be great. I'm just going to tell you what a Japanese show is like. You walk out on the stage, it will be quiet. There'll be no cheering. The Japanese audience will be quiet. You will start playing. They will dance around and applaud at the end of you playing. And then there will be silence again until you start playing again. And we went, what? And he went, don't take any offense. That is just the Japanese way with reference to shows. And we went, oh, all right, fine. We walked out on stage and sure enough, deadly silence. Just silence. And then I think the first track we played was Horror Show. So Pete just went, and we started playing. Then all of a sudden, it kicked off. It kicked off more than I'd ever seen it ever kick off ever before. It went absolutely mental. And then I think from then, I remember looking over at Pete Gunn, and even he was just like, oh my God, I was not expecting that. And then usually stage invasion happens at the end of the show. A guy managed to get on the stage doing Horror Show. He managed to get the microphone from Peter and he started singing Horror Show in pidgin English. And then he ran to the back of the stage. He ran forward. He somersaulted off the front of the stage and got caught by the audience and crowd surfed around.
Oh, nice.
He just went mental. And then was the silence after that? There was absolutely none. The security ran ragged. It was glorious. That's what it was. It was glorious.
Amazing.
I'll go with that one.
Yeah, that's a good choice. Gary, this is a good time for me to say one of my favorite times I saw you was when you were playing the Christmas shows at the Forum in Kentish Town, 2003 time this was. And you played three nights in a row there. I managed to get to two of them. But I was digging through some old stuff and I found this. I think this may belong to you. An old drumstick. No.
No.
Is that not your kit?
Not your Zig Fair. Yeah, it was mine. Yeah. Oh. Gotcha. 5A. 5A, isn't it?
Five.
5A drumstick. There we go.
Yeah, 5A. Cormaster.
5B, it says.
5B Cormaster. There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, there you
go. Cool. Right. Lovely little memento.
Yeah, amazing show, that one. That was so Christmas.
You don't want it back, do you, Gary?
Yeah, I'll put it in.
Chuck it.
For a mile. Cool. Final question in the encore. Final question in the podcast, Gary. What is the Libertine song that you're proudest of?
Libertine song that I'm proudest of. Oh my goodness. I'm guessing it's my favorite Libertine song is Radio America.
Oh, cool.
Nice.
That's my favorite Libertine song. Because at the point of time of recording it, I think we were very kind of like historically intent on trying to reflect our likes, being the likes of the Kinks, being the likes of obviously the Beatles, being the likes of the Small Faces. And I think, for me personally, that ideology for me is best exemplified by the track Radio America. I think that track kind of like exemplifies the love of the likes of Django Reinhardt, the likes of the Beatles, the likes of the Kinks, and because of the way that it's arranged, because of the sound, we were working with this guy called Phil Harris, or as we prefer to call, Flaris, and he managed to supply us a bunch of original instruments. We got like a huge original 1960 stand-up bass. I was using a 1962 Ludwig Sparkle kit. The boys are using really old original electric guitars, and a really old Gretsch. I can't remember what the other one was. I know it was an old Gretsch. I can't remember what model Gretsch it was. And I think we working again with Mick and Bill, we managed to get the sound out of all of the instruments, and it was just beautiful. And plus, on top of it as well, Carl went out the night beforehand, and didn't come home. Naughty, naughty. He stayed out all night drinking. He stayed out all morning drinking. And by the time we were ready to record, he turned up to the studio about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, completely fucking wasted. Carl has been going all night long, completely wasted. And if you listen to Radio America, you'll hear like a glitch sound during the track. And that glitch sound is Carl falling asleep on the microphone.
Amazing. I have to listen back to that right now. After this chat.
I'll pass that during the recording. he was definitely not the first, and he definitely wasn't the last, because I'm definitely falling asleep doing things after being wasted as well.
Gary, thanks so much for giving us your time today. Obviously, the Libertines are such an important band to us and all your fans, so it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on to talk us through their incredible journey. So, thanks very much, and we really look forward to what comes next.
Thank you guys for having me. You guys stay safe, stay sane, and don't forget to wash your hands.